How's this? Good. Well, I imagine people will be drifting in the next bit of time. I know some people let us know that they're going to be late today, so we'll just get started. Welcome, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. My name is Heidi Born, and I get to come periodically and be with you for this class when Sylvia and Donald are busy and both are off teaching retreats separately from each other. So that's why I get to be here today. So I'm delighted. For those of you whom I haven't met, I live in Arcata, California, which is about 300 miles north of here, and I teach meditation up there, and Donald and Sylvia have been my primary mentors for a very long time, and I also am a small business person. So in my day job, I have a laundromat, and that's where I get a lot of my fuel for teaching. It's how do we take our everyday work and understand it from the perspective of mindfulness, and how do we integrate the Dharma into our work, and how does our work inform our practice? And so I find that my store, which is a big, busy neighborhood laundromat, and I have about 10 employees, gives me lots of fodder. There's stuff going on there all the time, and I am very committed to managing my business and my work through the lens of practice, because it really changes it. It makes it so alive, and it's keeps my practice accountable when I really put it into my everyday work. It's not just something that happens at 5 a.m. Sitting on the cushion or periodically going on retreat. It's really an everyday practice. So that's who I am. And because I only come to teach this class a few times a year, I do forget people's names for sure. And so if there's anybody here who is here for the first time to either Spirit Rock, would you say your name and let us know where you've come from? Oh, Mona, welcome. Wow, what brings you here?
I came for a wedding, and I'm hanging around the Bay Area today to go to Burning Man.
Oh, great. So perfect. You have some time in between.
Some peace before the
madness. Have you been to Burning Man before?
Yes.
Oh, good. So this is part of what you do. Yeah. That's great. Thank you for coming, Mona. Anybody else? Yes. Welcome, Laura. What brings you here? Great, great. So you came over. Was the traffic clogged up when you came over this morning? Yeah, I bet. Thanks for coming, Laura. Who else? Yeah.
I'm Bonnie, and I'm from Washington State.
Oh, welcome, Bonnie.
Here to visit my sister.
How sweet. I can see your sisters now that I look at you. That's great. Thank you for coming. Anybody else want to introduce themselves?
I'm not new to Spirit Rock, but it's been so long that I'll introduce myself. It's been 1986. I left New Palm Springs, Palm Desert. Before then, I was here since before the inception of Spirit Rock.
Yeah.
I was in Sylvia's yoga classes at College of Marin.
Wow. Wow, I'm sure she would have loved to have seen you again. Tell us your name, please.
Linda.
Linda, yeah. Thank you for coming. That's wonderful. So you've known Sylvia a long time. Who else? Welcome. Okay, then. So thank you. Thank you for coming. Before we have our sit this morning, I really enjoy talking a little bit before we settle into our meditation, and I want to share with you some of my thoughts about what I want to talk about today and why and how it can inform our meditation practice itself. So I think as we study, whether we study with teachers or whether we read books or whether we have a group that we might sit with or whatever our path is that brings us into some sort of study, and it's true with the Dharma and with mindfulness practice, that there are many pithy teaching lines, many adages, many maxims, phrases that we can hear that are helpful to us, that sometimes just let the penny drop a little bit when there's some phrase that puts our own challenges or our own experiences into some context. And that's the purpose of these small teaching tools. And there are many of them that help us all. But I think it is extremely important as we hear teachings, as we read, as we absorb them, to be careful about the places where they just sound really great and we adopt them through some element of blind faith, because on some level, this feels really good, this sounds right. But for me, in Dharma practice, what really transforms practice is listening to those teachings and then asking myself, well, how do I do that? And so, as an example, there are our loving kindness practice. May I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. That's beautiful, and that's a really important teaching. But I want to know how. You know, how do I get stuck? So I'm really teaching from that place now to integrate these kinds of teachings in my own practice and asking that question of myself all the time. How am I going to do this? And not like it's climbing a mountain, but actually just like, all right, so that is beautiful. That is an intention. That's where I want to go, but how am I going to get there? So I came across not long ago this phrase that you might know that says, pain is inevitable and suffering is an option. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
So I think many of us have heard that many, many times. And when I heard it recently, it was during a time where I have some of my own challenges. And I thought, that is just not true. And I just thought, I'm just not buying that. I don't see how that works. And so it sort of started me on a whole thing about looking at, is suffering really an option? We know pain happens, struggle happens. That's just, that part I'm not arguing with. But I started to think about, so is suffering akin to pain in the way grief is to loss? I don't know. So I just started thinking about it, and I said to one of my teachers, I'm in a huff about this. And I don't actually think it's true. And so we started reflecting on what I thought about that and how does it work. And it was great. The teacher who is actually Diana Winston, who is a Spirit Rock teacher, and sometimes I teach for UCLA. And when I teach mindfulness courses for UCLA, they give me the curriculum. And so I take it's a beginning level mindfulness course, and I take it into organizations. And so it was the week where the request in the curriculum is to teach pain is inevitable, suffering is an option. And I wrote to her and said, I'm not doing that. Because it's not authentic, it's not coming out of my practice, and I don't actually think that I can do that. And so she wrote back this great note and said, because perfect mentor teacher note to say, I trust your practice and I trust your teaching that you're going to figure out how to do that. I thought, okay, all right, that's really great, you have that confidence in me, but I don't know, I'm not so sure about that. And then actually, what she said was extremely helpful, which was, you know, you might consider that this is true It's just really, really hard. And that was very helpful, that sometimes when we come up against these things that trigger us, and we just say, forget it, I'm not doing that, it's just not true, to stop, you know, and to get a wider perspective and to feel those ways in which we do get triggered, and we say, no, that this widely accepted maxim isn't true, and I'm not buying it. So it shifted me. It shifted me to what I want to talk about today, which is how do the very, very subtle forms of suffering defined as arguing with whatever is going on, being in contention with what's really happening, how we bargain, how we're in denial, how we constantly, you know, push away what is happening and how we make it worse for ourselves within that. So questioning these things is so valuable, to give ourselves the space to pause and say, I've heard this a million times and I've just accepted that it's true, but maybe it's not true. And then to do the work, to do the practice, say, oh yeah, now I get it. I think this actually has some real validity. So here's a poem for us to start. This is called Bear in Mind. A bear is chasing me through a meadow, and I'm running as fast as I can, but he's gaining on me. It seems he's always gaining on me. I'm running and running, but also thinking I should turn around and say, stop it! Stop chasing me! We both know you aren't going to catch me. All you ever do is chase me. So think about it. Why bother? The bear does stop, and he sits on his haunches and thinks, or seems to think, and then the bear says to me, I have to chase you. You know that. Or you should. And sure, we both know I'll never catch you, so why not just give us both a break and stop thinking about me? But with that said, he gets back on 4 feet, sticks his long pink tongue out, licks down both sides of his snout. Then he sighs, looks behind himself, and then at me, and says, okay, ready when you are. Now, isn't that what our minds are like? You know, when we have the repetitive thoughts that just don't stop, and then we see them, and we try to disengage from them, and then they just creep right back in, and there they are. And so that's how suffering works. We make a terrible thing more terrible. We do. And so we want to see these ways that it happens, and I love that poem. But to ask ourselves, are these teachings that we hear and that we absorb, how do they function in our lives? Instead of just rejecting it when it just feels too difficult to grasp, too difficult to actually integrate. So I love the teaching from the Buddha in the Kalama Sutta that says, don't believe me, go find out for yourself. You know, what an amazing teaching to give us that is still so alive now. Because what it does is it instills in us confidence that here is a role model, and all our teachers are role models. All the people in our lives, whether they're teachers or not, are modeling. We're all modeling all of the time. Whatever we do, we are modeling. But to give us that kind of freedom to explore and not say it's like this and you have to do it this way is a beautiful gift that is inherent in our practice, that gives us, I hope, it gives me and hope you, faith in this practice, that it can hold my doubts. It can hold this questioning and welcomes it. And then we start to see, I think, the truth of what the Buddha taught, that suffering actually is an option. It is optional. We'll look at that today. But that it is true that life is difficult for everyone, and it is what we do with that difficulty, right? I teach one thing, the suffering and the end of suffering, the Buddha's primary teaching in there. But first, before we can move into a place of managing how what our relationship is with the natural difficulties of our lives, we have to know what's happening. And this is the place that's also a pithy place of practice. And this is what mindfulness practice asks us to do, to know what is happening in the mind, what is happening in the heart, what is happening in the body, to get to know our minds intimately through the immediacy of our experience. And this is why our meditation practice matters so much. It is so critical to sit down quietly and to have that intimate experience of what is happening in the immediacy. I love that expression, the immediacy of our experience. What am I thinking? What is present? And very importantly, what is not present? This is critical. It's the presence of whatever we're aware of, but also to be aware of what is not present. So this is mindfulness of the mind. A busy mind is like this. A calm mind is like this. A frustrated mind is like this. A mind of ease is like this. So we know when we actually have a good thing going, when we feel okay, that we recognize, I'm actually okay right now. This feels great. And to take it in and let it integrate in our bodies and in our hearts. So as much as we notice difficulty, we have to notice non-difficulty. So I want to bring in a couple of Zen perspectives before we sit. This comes from Thich Nhat Hanh, and you might be familiar with it. It's called No Toothache. Anybody know about no toothache? This is really fun. When I have a toothache, I discover that not having a toothache is a wonderful thing. That is peace. I had to have a toothache in order to be enlightened, to know that not having one is wonderful. My non-toothache is peace, is joy. But when I do not have a toothache, I don't seem to be very happy. Therefore, look deeply at the present moment and see that I have a non-toothache, and that can make me very happy. Isn't that encouraging? Isn't that great? And if we take it literally, we know that having a toothache is really, really painful, and it can color our entire experience, or whatever the physical ailment might be happening, and certainly our emotional ailments, experiences that we have. So to know when we're okay is so important. So in our meditation today, the invitation is to notice what is present, but also notice what isn't present. Because we're so, you know, whatever is present draws our attention because it's the stronger sensation, it's the stronger stimulus. It's harder to pay attention to non-stimulating events. So here's another piece. This is from Zen Master Kodo Sawaki. To you who are out of your mind, trying so hard to attain peace of mind. You lack peace of mind because you're running after an idea of total peace of mind. That's backwards. Be attentive to your mind in each moment, no matter how unpeaceful it may seem to be. Great peace of mind is realized only in the practice within this unpeaceful mind. When dissatisfaction is finally accepted as dissatisfaction, peace of mind reigns. Isn't that great? When dissatisfaction is finally accepted as dissatisfaction, we let go. We can have peace of mind within this messy mind. Because it is messy in there. And sometimes it's not. But we are so, we are constantly acclimating. So when we're uncomfortable, we're constantly trying to make ourselves more comfortable, whether it's in the mind or in the heart, with our emotions or physically. Is it too hot in here? Is it too cold in here? Can we just experience things as they are? That's our practice. It's hard work. But I love that idea that we can have peace of mind when we just say, yeah, this is how it is. This is what's happening in my mind right now. So as we sit, just let your mind be as it is. All right, so we'll sit for about half an hour or so. Coming into a comfortable posture that's at ease. Don't have to make it complicated, just be comfortable. I want to offer you some meditation instructions from Ajahn Sujato. When you meditate, just relax. Don't try to control your mind. Don't try to stop it going here and there. Just be peaceful. Don't watch your breath. Just breathe. Be at peace when your mind is still. Be at peace when your mind is wandering. Don't judge one state as better than the other. It's just how the mind is. Let mindfulness settle down with the breath. As you stop judging, stop trying, and stop controlling, peace will come to you. Welcome it. from wherever you are right now, coming back to a sense of your breathing. Just simply breathe and know you're breathing. Really letting your mind drop inside the breath, inhabiting it. Noticing the sensations and the rhythm of breathing. Simply just noticing. And now becoming aware of sensation in the body. Is there a strong sensation that is drawing your attention? And it doesn't necessarily have to be uncomfortable, but just simply something that you're noticing. It might be an itch or a tingle or the pressure where the body is making contact with the chair or the cushion. Whatever seems to be a predominant sensation, see if you can just notice it. Maybe describe it to yourself with a few words. Just this sense of, oh, it's like this. This is how this sensation is. Becoming aware of what is present. And now, see if you can move your awareness somewhere in the body that is very neutral. Might be the hands, might be the feet, the elbows, could even be the earlobes. Maybe a part of the body that you don't often notice. And becoming aware of what neutrality feels like. Non-sensation. And is there, in fact, some sensation just by becoming aware of this neutral place in the body? And now moving back into the stronger sensation that might have some dominance in your field of awareness. And once again, just noticing the stronger sensation. What is present within it? And what is not present within it? Letting that go. And last time, to go back to this neutral place. Just check out. What does that feel like? What is present? What is not present? And coming back to the breath now, just simply breathe. And we'll move into our practice of offering out loud into our time here together thoughts and prayers and blessings for anyone who comes to mind that you would like to offer out some goodwill. I've been thinking about the firefighters all over the state and other states too. As I drove down yesterday through the dense smoke, thinking about all of the beings, all of us, who are affected by this, wishing that we can all be as well as possible as we go through this fire season. Who are you thinking about? We hold each other's joys and sorrows. It's such a privilege for us to do that. It's an honor. It moves our hearts. So let's just have a couple of minutes of metta practice for all of us here and all of those who we're thinking of. May all beings everywhere be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May all beings be truly happy and deeply peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong and physically at ease. May we all take care of ourselves and each other and live with well-being. So let's take a few minutes for a break. 5 or 8 minutes or so. Okay, well, welcome back. A few years ago, I remember receiving one of those catalogs came in the mail of an outdoor gear company and all of the beautiful clothing that one can purchase from a gorgeous catalog that has outrageously beautiful pictures of outdoor places, and I'm an outdoor adventurer, so I get a lot of vicarious positive hit out of reading those kinds of catalogs, and I think that's their purpose. You know, you look at these beautiful catalogs and imagine that you too can go there, and sometimes we can, and it's great, that sort of anticipatory imagining about great adventures. So on the cover of this catalog was the background picture was some high alpine place that you could see a snow-capped mountain out in the distance, and the sky was as blue, perfect blue as you could imagine. There weren't any clouds, and there were wildflowers on the ground in the foreground, and then there was this man who looked to be in about, I would guess, his 40s, trail running, and sweaty, but in all the right trail running gear, and cresting this trail up at the top of this pass, and you could see he was working really hard and all of his muscles were really taut, and so a buff guy in really great shape trail running. And the caption on the front of this catalog was "Suffer Better." I thought that was just brilliant, and I thought that is the best marketing tool that you could imagine, that this is really hard work and you can suffer so much better if you just buy the stuff we're selling. It's a great, great tool, and I thought, I wondered, wow, as a marketing manager, somebody who is involved in Buddhist practice, this person is kind of getting it. Or did it just occur to them that why I do this trail running and it hurts my body all the time, but there's somehow in some of our most intense work that we do, whether it's physical or not, it's really satisfying, isn't it? When we were working really, really, really hard and we accomplish some sort of goal or intention, the pain is worth it. So how can we suffer better? So that has really stuck with me, and I think this is our task. I think this is what we are really doing. And I would like to open up our conversation as we go through the next hour together and talk about our experiences of how our challenges do become more challenging by what we overlay on them, usually not being aware of it. So, you know, how do we take a difficult situation and make it worse by our reactions, our responses? How are we in relationship to our difficulties? So the first question, I'd just really like to open this up. Do you think suffering's an option? Like, what is your relationship to that? We'll get the mic. And if you could say your name, please.
My name's Mark. Excuse me. I have a couple of things to say about this. Excuse me. I'm sort of a math guy, a science kind of guy, and I heard this equation in one of my Dharma things I listened to, which is that suffering equals pain times resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can, you know, if I can get resistance to zero, then I don't suffer. Well, you know, that's easier said than done. I've had some experience in my life. I've always been dentist averse. I really would get very upset, very uptight about going to the dentist. And I'd sit there and I'd need the gas and I need this, I need that, and I'm just like this. But since I started this practice, I've completely changed my attitude, and I use it as a real practice opportunity. And so now when I go to the dentist, I'm constantly practicing, thinking everything is impermanent, and I smell that smell, or I hear that noise, or that feeling hits my gum, and I feel it, and I go, okay, it's a sensation. It's a sensation. Yeah. And then it goes away. I go,
yeah,
it's gone. And my suffering, my resistance has dropped a lot. My suffering is way, way down. And so I do believe that there is, as long as you're mindful and can realize what's going on, I really believe that you can, you know, I mean, like I said, it's not easy, but using the tools that the Dharma helps you think about, and when you practice, that you can actually reduce that resistance and bring the suffering down.
Yeah.
The pain's always there. I mean.
Thank you. That's right. That's exactly right. It's our relationship to it. I want to say I'm totally with you on the dentist. I completely understand that, and I will make up all kinds of stories 2 weeks in advance of a teeth cleaning about how can I cancel this appointment. Certainly I have something else that's much more important to do than go do that. Because it is fundamentally really uncomfortable, and we're very vulnerable in that position. And I do think when we recognize this is just a half an hour, and yeah, it is going to be uncomfortable for this half an hour, we don't make it as bad. But yeah, that's right. I agree. Thank you. One more.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm so glad we sat after you brought up this topic, because I was kind of like you. My brain sort of went to these really big, awful scenarios that really hard to make sense of that. Like, you know, Syria, mothers who have lost their children. Like, and then when I was sitting, I'm like, yeah, but that's not my reality right now. And that's not where you start, you know. And so I was realizing, like, in just this moment sitting here, how do I suffer? Like, even in just, you know, thinking, oh, I should be doing this or I should be doing that. And in that way, I could make it more tangible. Like, oh, yeah. This moment, yes, I can see where it's an option, whether or not to follow a train of thought that ultimately makes me more uncomfortable than following my breath.
Yeah. It's a brilliant practice, isn't it? When it gives us that, so good. I'm glad. That's great. Thank you. So when I said earlier that in my own exploration of this, in the cloudiness of my doubting, of really looking at this topic, and I said, is suffering to pain what grief is to loss? And I don't think it is. I think that's that grief is certainly very natural. This is how we move through our losses. That's the feeling. This is what comes up. And but I do believe that suffering is different, the overlay that we have. So, of course, this brings us to the Buddha's first teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And how do they work? And I recognize that probably most of us have heard the teachings on the Four Noble Truths many, many times, and going back over them again in a way that just want to talk about it and just bring some, maybe a new idea to it. Or maybe there are no new ideas, but it's worth just talking about. So we know by definition, first noble truth, that life is difficult. It just is. And we all have pain and we all have sorrow to varying degrees and in varying circumstances and in different ways that we experience it. And one of the pieces for me that makes my relationship to it not contested is recognizing that the pain, the challenges that we have in our lives, it's not a mistake. It's like getting sick is not a mistake. The body degrades. This is what happens. We go through these periods of ill health and good health, back and forth, back and forth. This is just what it means to live a human life. So when we have great challenge, to not argue with it, to say, all right, this is just what's happening now. It's true in the body, it's true in the mind, it's true in the heart, and it's true in our circumstances, our external circumstances, for sure. And that this second truth, that there's a cause of the suffering, so the difficulty happens, but the suffering is our relationship to the difficulty. It's our constant arguing with what is happening, whether it's through denial, whether it's through righteousness, insisting that things be different than they are, whether it's this bargaining and arguing, we can be so stubborn. And so this is the thing that we want to see, are the really subtle ways we reject whatever is going on. It's so subtle. When we get into repetitive thought patterns, I can't believe, and then we fill in the blank. You know, how often do we have that refrain that can happen? And it keeps us in that cycle of suffering. It keeps us in that, it's a gerbil wheel, right? I mean, it just keeps us going around and around and around, telling the same stories over and over again. And what that's doing on a neurobiological level is it's reinforcing those neural pathways of rejection and negativity. It's really reinforcing our negativity bias. So it's so easy to see what's wrong. And when we can see that we're doing it, we need to literally shift. And this is why we do compassion practice, loving kindness practice. We notice the good. We take in joy. The practice of noticing what is absent. So that practice of noticing the absence of difficulty in all of its forms. Make sense? You with me on that? And we do this in the body, you know, when we do this, that in the meditation practice, if we had pain and then we go to a neutral place in the body. The reason for that is that we start experiencing non-contention. We start experiencing that even when there are things happening for us that we find challenging and difficult, there are probably also simultaneously things happening that are okay, that are really holding us and supporting us. So I love Tony Bernhard's way of discussing the Four Noble Truths, which I know some of you have heard because he taught it in here probably about a year ago, and I think it changed a lot of our thinking. Tony Bernhard does some work in prisons, and so, you know, he can't talk about the Buddha in Folsom Prison, but he can talk about, this is how he teaches the Four Noble Truths. And I realize I've only said the first two. But the first one is shit happens, right? We know this. It happens. The second one, we make it worse. So that concept that there's a cause of suffering, so the difficulty happens and we can make it worse by all of the ways we reject whatever is happening. The third noble truth is that there is an end of suffering, or as Sylvia says, peace is possible. Or as Tony says, we don't have to make it worse. And this is the pithy place that I want to talk mostly about today, which is how do we go from the second noble truth of our grasping, our clinging, our rejecting, making things worse, to I have a choice. How do I want to be in this moment? And making that connection from being caught to disentangling, that's what we're talking about, the end of suffering. My experience of it, that's how I relate to this. And the fourth, of course, is the Eightfold Path. But before we get there, this place of choice, how do we choose? And this is what I think mindfulness gives us. Mindfulness, in so many ways, says, okay, now what? This is what's happening now. What do you want to do about it? How do you want to be with this? And it's a brilliant practice because the Buddha said to us, you will find out from your direct experience what is the most appropriate response. What does this feel like in the mind and the heart and the body? What is it bringing up for you? Can you pause long enough to feel it, to become aware of it, and then to act in a wise way? Hogan Bays is the husband of Jan Chosen Bays, who is a Zen priest in Oregon. And he too is a Zen priest. And here's his poem on this. It's called In This Passing Moment. In this passing moment, karma ripens and all things come to be. I vow to choose what is. If there is cost, I choose to pay. If there is need, I choose to give. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there is sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it is my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. That's what this is. So that piece of recognizing in its granularity what's actually happening and saying, okay, I'm in it. How am I going to do with this? I'm in the pool. I better swim. In this passing moment, Hogan, H-O-G-E-N, Bays, B-A-Y-S. So this is the pithy place, to see the cause and choosing to stop making it worse. And we do that. One of my favorite stories from Sylvia that she told, I don't know when it was, but it illustrates this so perfectly. She was making big Passover meal, Seder, a couple of years ago. And if you know about Passover meal, there are ritual foods. And one of the ritual foods that we eat is gefilte fish. Anybody know about gefilte fish? Right. So you either really love it or you really don't, is typically how this is. My grandmother made fantastic gefilte fish, and it's ground up white fish or cod, and it's got to be made with the right amount of fat and the right spices, and it takes a while to make it. And it's often served one piece on a dish with a dollop of horseradish, typically red horseradish. So she was having Seder at her house, and her granddaughter came into the kitchen to help her serve the gefilte fish, and one piece on a plate, and each person gets a plate of gefilte fish. And her granddaughter said, "This is terrible. And now you're putting horseradish on it? How can you make a terrible thing more terrible?" It's perfect, right? Because it's what we do. We make terrible things more terrible all the time. And we don't always know it. So this is our practice, to really get to know what we're doing, what we're feeling, what we're thinking, and how that manifests in our actions. And does it support our well-being or does it not support our well-being? So how do we get from the second noble truth, rather, to the third? Wendell Berry, Our Real Work, is the name of this short poem. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. and that when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. So we might say, oh, thanks a lot. You know, I need my challenges to really get to do the real work. But actually we do. This is where the rubber meets the road, is when we're saying, okay, this is the real difficulty of what is happening, and how do I want to best be with it? So I want to offer you some reflection questions that I use in my own practice when the going is tough or there's whatever I'm dealing with. And these are questions that I think of, excuse me, as compass questions. And I'd like us to just talk about it and see what you think. Some of these questions I made up, and some of them you'll know I didn't make up. So the first place we start when we're in a little bit of a challenge or a pickle or confused, really sitting inside of our doubts and confusion, is what we've been doing all morning. What am I noticing right now? What am I noticing right now? What is present? What is absent in both sensation, emotions, and thoughts? So just for yourself, right now, just go inside for a moment and notice, what are you noticing right now? And when we come from that place of coming back into our awareness and our presence, we might be that we notice physical discomfort, we might notice a very distracted mind, or we might become aware of some piece of information that really helps us get our bearings. So this is a bearing practice. How do we maintain our bearings? The next question comes from the Buddha. And we'll talk about this one a little bit. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? This is a fantastic question. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? So when I think about this, it connects me both to my short-term and the long-term. Because we don't do everything for the long-term. Because we might want to go out and have an ice cream. Great, it's fine. And so we don't have to be paralyzed by, you can't be spontaneous. Of course we can be spontaneous in our lives. But when we're coming to some of these bigger questions, these bigger decisions that we make, this question connects us to a deeper place in ourselves. One time I was sitting in a retreat and one of the teachers said, you know, when I'm stuck, I say to myself, what would my 85-year-old self tell me to do here? If I could be in the fullness of my wisdom towards the end of my life, what do I know? It gives us space for the wisdom to arise. So what do you think of that question? Do you like that? What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? Or do you have an answer? What, when you do it, does really support you? And we can pass the mic around if you want, and if somebody has a comment. Yeah.
The first one I was thinking about was breathing. So often, I had a situation recently where I...
Thank you. I could have really shot off a very angry email that would have just caused massive explosions everywhere, but I just didn't. And I noticed how things calmed. We're not necessarily, the problem isn't necessarily all solved, but it's drastically de-escalated.
Way to go. Yeah. Way to go. And in our world of digital media and how lightning fast it is, and we can't take it back. I mean, I've noticed on some, I think on my email now, you have 3 seconds to unsend. That's not very long. But really, really important, refraining, restraining, and this practice of renunciation, and this is how this practice comes in, one of the paramis. Can we let go of that urge right now, that way to satisfy our And that can be a really hard thing to do, right? I just want to get it off my chest. So yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Long-term welfare and happiness. Yeah.
I have an opportunity now, having retired this last year, to think about long-term, what's going to be beneficial to me. And having spent most of my life running away from me, it's now time to stop and figure out who I am. And that can be pretty scary at times.
Yeah.
But I've been away from Spirit Rock now for 3 weeks on a cruise. Tough life. And so it gave me time to stop and think.
Mm-hmm.
And I led a busy life, and now I don't have to. I don't have to really care about who judges me, because there's a lot of things I can give up. I don't practice law anymore, and I don't teach anymore. So now, what do I want to do? And it's just go be quiet for a long time, and then it'll sort itself out.
Brilliant. Thank you. Isn't that an interesting thing about how we do go through developmental phases of what's happening in our personal lives and in our own minds? And is it time to work? Is it time to produce a family? Is it time to back off? And so long term means different things for different ones of us. You know, somebody who's 85 long term might be 2 years. Somebody who's 5 years old, it's unfathomably long. And so being able to check in with yourself when you have the space. This is why we need retreat. We need to come together to be able to talk about these things, to give ourselves that space.
I don't take out long-term leases and I don't buy suits.
I don't take out long-term leases and I don't buy suits with 2 pair of pants. That's great. Thank you. Yeah, Mona.
I found that whenever it is that I find myself going to that space of suffering, it's because I've developed a story where I'm contextualizing something and thereby giving it meaning.
Yeah.
And whenever I catch myself doing that, I always ask myself, you know, if I weren't thinking about this, would it still be real?
Great question.
And oftentimes it's not the case, but oftentimes there's still a little bit of realness left, so then I get curious and I say, well, how am I looking at this? What lens am I choosing to put in front of this experience that's causing me to relate to it in a way that's making me unhappy?
Very skillful.
And what I've noticed is in every single instance in your life, you have the chance to either change the circumstance itself, which oftentimes you don't actually have the choice if it's something bigger than you and out of your control. But you always have the chance to change your perception about it. And where I learned this was through the work of Viktor Frankl, mm-hmm. Man's Search for Meaning, where, you know, you think about this man, he ended up being a really famous neurologist and psychiatrist, but he was a Holocaust survivor. And he talks about his experience and how he was able to survive that. And you say, okay, well, he was in the same place with millions of other people receiving the same type of atrocious treatment. What was it in his experience that helped him come out of it alive and come out of it actually well adjusted? And it's mm-hmm. the fact that he made that choice.
Yeah. Yeah. So this, and that could be our genetics. It could be our neurology. It
totally.
Could be all these different conditions that
totally.
Actually in that moment gave him that ability to have a wider perspective. Mm-hmm. So Viktor Frankl has an extremely famous quote where he says, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And it's in that space where I think he says something like, we have our power to choose. But that's really what we're talking about over and over again, about how does pain not become suffering? What do we do? Where are the choice points? And it might just be like a tiny little space, right?
Mm.
But this practice is training us to pause and to see what's here. Thank you, Mona. Okay. So the next question, this comes from Suzuki Roshi. The story goes that one of his students came to him at some point and said, "Roshi, there's so much to do here, there's so much to learn. What is the most important thing?" And he says, "To find out what is the most important thing." Thank you very much, Zen Paradox, right? What is the most important thing? And it's a great question because sometimes we just have to stop. And there may be so many things going on that maybe it's a very practical thing. Right now, what is the most important thing? So it gives us the, it offers us a pause. It lets us have the space to prioritize, to check in before we proceed. And again, it moves us to a wider perspective. And this wider perspective, we need this over and over and over again because we get myopic and we get so constricted that it's hard to see the big picture, and the big picture gives us that space, gives us the long view, gives us a way to prioritize. In fact, there's a great acronym that you might like. It's called STOP. And this is when we're caught, and so we're triggered by something. And the acronym of STOP stands for S, is actually stop, like literally stop. T, tune in, take a breath. In the O is observe, just what we're talking about, what is happening. And based on what we observe from stopping and tuning in, we make a choice to either proceed or park it. Don't keep going when we know we need to not keep going. We need to continue to pause. So you might like that. You like that. I like that one, and it's very accessible. Stop, practice. Stop, tune in, take a breath, observe, proceed. And if you practice with that, you can do it really quickly. You can do it in one breath cycle. Just when you feel yourself get caught, you can really just bring that to mind. And you don't have to go through each one unless you want to, but it just becomes a practice. So what is the most important thing? You know, this is different for all of us, yes.
Another source, embracing every moment. And I knew right away that for me it's love. And what I noticed is because I knew that so deeply, that when I, as I am in a struggle right now, with technology and trying to figure it out and being angry at the people who were requiring me to figure this out. And I was writing an email and I fortunately reviewed it. But I think it's because I really took that in and I said, if I say this, is this going to help this person help me? You know, I don't think so. And I took it out.
Way to go. Yeah. So the most important thing is that ability to come to what is it that I really need right now and how am I going to get it? If I say this, is this person going to help me? Yeah, it's love. Yeah. It's that openness.
Yeah, not to put my suffering out there so somebody else can feel bad.
Yeah. Well, so this is the teaching of the two arrows, right? That Donald teaches all the time as a core teaching. So again, this is the same thing we're talking about. In life, we have difficulty. So we get shot with the first arrow. This is just how it is. And then what? And then what? So we're frustrated with the technology that we're being forced to incorporate into our lives. And then there's maybe the customer service person on the other end who might be trying to help us and we unload. Right? We shoot a bunch of arrows. Does it help?
Actually, I'm trying to publish a paper, so it's even... I have to do the revisions, and I have to get the revisions in order to do them, and that's my struggle. I can't figure it out, but
yeah,
I will. I came here instead of sitting home struggling.
Oh, good.
It's helped.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you. Okay. The next question. What is the kind thing to do? And this is, I think that you'll see that through all of these questions, they're all different facets of the same question, which is, what am I supposed to do? Now what? That's really the life existential question of, how am I going to live this life? Life is difficult by definition. I want to do the best I can. And there are all these different ways to approach it. But that question of what is the kind thing to do, actually, I think that it really gives, it opens up a space for us to get out of our own way. It kind of dissolves our own personal agenda, and we can see that really there is a consequence to everything that we do. This is how interconnection works, because of this, that. And we know, I think, that what we learn through our loving kindness practice is that when we offer goodwill out into the world and we wish well for others, we don't know if it actually affects that other person. But we know that it affects us. And that when we are cultivating this kindness and compassion in our own hearts, we behave better. We just do. We just become kinder all the time, as a default setting. And so if we can remember when we're really frustrated, not only what is the most important thing, what do I need for the long run, but right now in this moment, what is the kind thing to do? That is a very helpful compass question also. It gives us direction. We can find out within that, is there ill will present in me? How is that functioning in me? This is important because this is really, I think this is a primary point of our practice, is to dissolve ill will. Some people may say that, well, awakening is the most important thing. That's what we're doing here. And this is a kindness as a path towards awakening, coming into the reality of what is happening and how can I be with my life. How can we be of service? That's another way to work with that question of what is the kind thing to do. And so through these questions, we start seeing again that they're all connected with each other. So do you have an experience of what is the kind thing to do? Anybody? Yeah.
I think for myself, everything you've talked about this morning, you know, bringing in what is the kind thing to do, holds them all. For myself, let's see, I'm close enough, let's see, I'm 71, so I'm able to feel the wonderful feeling of grandmotherliness. It's one of the beauties of aging. I mean, I didn't know. It's not just a feeling. Mm-hmm. I've worked with kids for a long time, and little kids I've worked with, and I came into a time when I went from teacher or nanny to grandma. You know, and I don't have my own children, no grandchildren. But it's like, yeah, sure you can. Come on over. You know, so I can do that with myself this morning. I went through a series of traumas in the last 6 years. And I want to put a word in for suffering, as a matter of fact, and rejection, and bringing compassion and kindness to however you respond. When I first heard bringing compassion to resistance, it opened my eyes a bit, you know, or rather my heart. But so I put on, I rejected a lot of feelings that I had as I went through. And now I'm in the place of, if I were 85, I would encourage myself to take the time I need. And in fact, although I earn my own income, move away from that focus. Don't drop it altogether, but shift. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have skills in both directions, earning my income and practice. So I have some, I hope, agility. But my 85-year-old self is, of course, you know, of course, and I do have a lot of support, follow that. And even though it's anxiety producing, even more anxiety, you know, allow myself to rest the focus on finances and bring up, you know, all more anxiety, you know, and all the fears, terrors that go with that right now. But I very much appreciated your presence, our conversation this morning.
Thank you for what you've shared too. Yeah. Anybody else on what is the kind thing to do? Yes.
I am 86.
Aha, okay.
I don't know that I have wisdom yet, but coming here, I also was a psychotherapist, a cognitive therapy, and this to me is similar because of the way you look at things, and if you can shift where you are a few feet, sometimes you can see things in a very different way. But after because my husband died in November, and it's been really hard. But
I'm sorry.
What I've learned is, I call it the one-day thing. I get the arrow, the first arrow, and then I give myself 1 day to suffer. And I try to keep it in quote marks, kind of. But I do have time now to think. And when I walk, I like to walk by myself because I observe. I love nature. It's just my church, my being. When you were describing the catalog, I think I've seen it. I have
loved it. Yeah.
And I did ask, my daughter asked me what I wanted to do on Mother's Day, and I said, go ziplining. So my daughter from the East Coast came out, and my granddaughter, and we had 3 generations flying through to space. That felt really good, but I have time to think, and I know I have a limited lifetime. And driving to Terra Linda last week, I was like 6 cars behind this vehicle, this truck, which was swinging back and forth and tipped over. I've come down several times on Port of Swallow. But when I came home, I thought, God, this life is so fragile. Yeah. It is so fragile. So my existence now, I have a wonderful relationship with my daughters. I have a wonderful relationship with my grandchildren. They're adults. And I try to be as kind as I can to people. Whether I'm shopping, whether I meet them walking. And I have so many nice relationships. And I know people said you aren't observed when you're old. But I've found if you're kind to people, if you see them, you listen to them. That's what I can give at this stage.
Thank you very much.
It's not so bad being 86, but you have to work at it.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad you went ziplining. What a great thing.
That's good.
Catching you.
Catching
you. That's great.
I think the most fun is having 3 generations share the joy.
Congratulations. Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, let's move on, because we have 13 minutes. So we're going to go a little bit quicker through these next three questions. All right, and they're all getting, you can see how they're all moving into each other. So this one, I think you'll also recognize, is what makes my heart sing? What makes me come alive? This is so important, to be engaged in what we love and to not miss our lives, and to really recognize, what is it? Where is your passion? And can you spend time doing what you love? And this goes to, we know this quote from Howard Thurman that says, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive, and go do that. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive. This is another compass question, is to always come back to ourselves about, what is it that I love? Because when we do what we love, we are making very real contribution. And we all love something different or differently. And so that's the coolest thing, is that we don't have to be passionate about everything. Just because one person's passion is this and another is that doesn't change the importance of their individual passions, but we need all of them. So that's really exciting. To think about, to give yourself the space to say, what is it for me? And can you find a way to do that? It doesn't mean you only do that, because maybe it's something that doesn't pay the bills. And we all know that, you know, we need to keep a roof over our heads to the best we can. But it might be something that we do on the side that is just so important that it really keeps, it's nourishing, it's part of what keeps us going. And I think that when we are engaged with what matters to us and what really engages us, it brings out our best selves. And that's, I know what I want for myself, is that I want to find ways that my best self is accessible and I can offer it out. That's, I think, how we make a big difference in our own lives, but in our communities, is bringing what is the best self. And that's, I didn't put that on here, but that's another question. What is the most wholesome, beneficial, beautiful expression of myself? This is another thing to think about. What are those things that need, that when they're present, that's the expression of me? So the next one is, this is the question for myself, is what evokes my reverent heart? Because it's very important, I believe, to feel awe, to feel reverence, to be able to look around and see the bigger picture, and to actually feel awe. And in fact, I can't speak to this in an educated way, but there is some research that is being done on the neurobiological level about what is happening in the brain with the experience of awe, and what does that stimulate in us. It's so important to have that feeling of having our breath be taken away. What stops us in our tracks? And anybody familiar with the Big Sing? Did you know about it, Kay?
Yes.
So, did you get to do it?
Privately.
Yeah. So the Big Sing was a recent event about a month ago, where that was the LA Master Chorale, which is a phenomenally, it's an incredible chorus in Los Angeles, conducted by Eric Whitaker, who is really beloved choral director, put together something in California called the Big Sing, which was 10,000 voices around the state coming together to sing by live stream, of having different choral directors come to conduct the LA Master Chorale at the Disney Center in Los Angeles. But it was live streamed in Sacramento and in Berkeley and in Fresno and actually in Arcata. And I'm telling you about it, and I have chills. And one of the things that brings out my best self and that awe and reverence is singing with a whole bunch of people, just for the sake of singing, not for performance, not for any end goal, but just to get together and sing. And the first song that everybody sang together was Bill Withers' Lean on Me with Rollo Dilworth conducting, and he's dancing all over the stage, and the first note came out and so many of us just burst into tears because it was such a powerful experience of joy together and doing something that was so beautiful. And the residual of that, I know in my mind and my heart and my body, of feeling that kind of awe and reverence and joy, changed me for about a week. I could really feel it. And so to take these experiences seriously, they really matter. And the last question, this comes from Emerson. And this is, I don't know where I got this, so somehow it's in my notes. I hope it's true. That the story goes that, and he would meet with friends who he hadn't seen in a while, his standard question for this person was, "What has become clear to you since last we met?" It's a great question. Imagine just making a habit of meeting with a friend and saying, "What have you learned lately?" Or, "What's become clear to you since the last time you came to Spirit Rock?" This is great, because then we actually get to take stock. It keeps us alive, it keeps us learning, but we also get to take heart in the fact that we are engaged and we are learning and we're keeping it up. So I love that question. So this is a practice. These are reflection questions. You can take any or all of them and see how it changes your relationship of the fact of difficulty and how we can disentangle and dissolve suffering, or prevent the suffering from arising, or see it a little more clearly, and apply these questions when we're stuck. Apply them to whatever is happening for us. Apply one, apply two, whatever it is. Or develop your own compass questions. These are just what has come up for me, you know, and I've heard different teachings over time that this is what I use. So I offer it to you as reflection questions to support your practice. Any questions? Yeah, Kate.
It's not a question.
A group of us swim in Tomales Bay all year long, and during the winter months, getting into the water could feel like pain, but but our job when we're doing this is to remember that it's a sensation and not pain necessarily.
Yeah.
And I think approaching practice with pain is useful. You know, is this pain or is this sensation? Is this total grief or is this something I can work around? But confronting it and allowing it on a regular basis, I find really helpful.
Thank you. That's a really, really helpful addition. Yeah, I mean, people that get into Tomales Bay or the Bay, what is the difference between pain and sensation? Can I manage this? And that is what we're talking about. And I think the answer is yes. Yes, we can.
Really quick, in terms of awe, I went and saw the Magritte exhibit yesterday. MoMA, if you haven't been, I mean, it's just, I'm not even an art person, but it takes your breath away.
Great.
Really beautiful.
So the experience of awe, we can remember them. This is the other thing that's cool about our neurobiology that we're learning, is that we can remember experiences of awe, and it stimulates those same places in the brain that were stimulated when it happened. So we're reconditioning the neural pathways towards this well-being. So, and it's amazing. Just give it a try. Find out for yourself. Try this. When you're in a funk or even not in a funk, remember some of those most beautiful experiences you've had and let them come into you as if it's happening now. So let's take a couple minutes to sit before we end. As we go through our lives, between now and the next time we come back to practice together, or wherever you practice, remembering that while we practice for our own benefit, for sure, what we do really matters, that we are practicing for the benefit of others. We come together and support each other in this practice and talk with each other. And this matters. Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that we sit for those who can't sit, and we walk for those who can't walk, and we cultivate peace and stillness in our lives for those who have no peace or stillness. And when that includes us, to really know that others are there for us, others are practicing for us. May all beings everywhere be safe, have enough to eat, have shelter, medicine, good friends, and come to the end of suffering. Thank you, everybody. Certainly a pleasure to be with you. I'll be back on Halloween. Yeah, what are we going to talk about on Halloween?